Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're blessed to have the chance to chat with international fungi photographer Stephen Axford. Stephen is an ambassador for Sony Australia and has an international reputation as a specialist in nature photography with a particular passion in macro fungi photography. He also has unique experience in time-lapse photography of fungi. The beauty and scientific accuracy of Stephen's fungi photography has captivated national and international media, fungi experts, and the general public, with a following that stretches from Patagonia to Vladivostok. His photographs have appeared in international books and magazines, including Nat Geo magazine in Spain and Portugal, Geo magazine in Germany, Roots magazine in Holland, The Guardian Observer in the UK, The Daily Mail UK, Civilization magazine of Beijing in China, and Sciences and Avenir Science magazine in France, just to name a few. In recent years, Stephen has shared the science of fungi and his experiences photographing fungi to packed houses and presentations in Australia, China, and Chile. A new direction in his work is collaborations with international universities and fungi organizations to photograph and document fungi in forests around the world. I'm excited to learn more from the world's most prolific fungi photographer about his craft, his relationship with Kingdom Fungi, and the awe-inspiring documentary work that he's creating. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, you are probably the best known mushroom and fungi photographer on the planet, and I'm sure a lot of people listening are already familiar with your work, or if they aren't consciously so, they've likely seen it in documentaries like Planet Earth, and obviously all over the internet. So I'm excited to learn more about these journeys you take all over the world, how you capture these photographs, how you take these time-lapse images. But before we dive into all of it, I am curious about this story of how you even became interested in fungi. Where you are in Australia, there's obviously a lot of interesting fungal diversity. But what turned you on to fungi, or what were some of those key events that led you to a relationship with mushrooms?
It was all by chance, really. A previous wife of mine had died of breast cancer, and then I had a life-threatening illness, which took me about 2 years to recover from. And I got over that in 2000, and I was really looking to reinvent myself. And I started walking a lot in down by the coast and in forests, just get up and walk by myself to strange and remote places and take a camera with me, which helped me slow down and stop and look at the scenery, smell the roses, as it were. And I started to notice fungus. And the very first fungus I noticed was this incredible purple fungus, which I found out later was Quaternarius archeri, which is an Australian species, which is a bright purple. Mm. And I'd never seen anything. I didn't even know there were purple fungus. So I took a picture of it. I had a little 2-megapixel camera, I think, just a point and shoot, and I rested it on the ground and took the picture and never looked back from there, really. I just started taking more and more pictures, posting them on the internet. I never thought anyone would certainly not pay for them. You know, some people post on the internet, and certainly at that stage, and they'd post really small pictures and they'd put copyright whoever all over them. I never bothered. I just posted them quite large, and I started to get a bit of a following for the fungus.
So that's where the addiction began. And then I guess, how did you expand your skills as a forager? You know, was it something that you did consciously to get better at hunting for mushrooms? Or was it just, I spent gobs of time outdoors, walking around? You know, how did that relationship with foraging develop for you?
Well, it was a slow thing, because I guess it happened from about 2000 on, so the last 20 years. And I was working in the computer industry. So it was very technical, but I knew nothing about life sciences at all, never done biology or zoology or anything like that. I knew very little about fungus. But as you take photographs, and then I'd buy a book on identifying fungus, and I'd gradually learn about it. And then as the internet got better, you find other people, maybe not locally, maybe, some distance away, but then they'd help you identify them. I came across a mycologist in Melbourne. I was living in Melbourne at the time, Tom May, and he helped me with some of them. And then I moved up here, which is the Northern Rivers area of New South Wales. And I thought I was coming up here, and I thought there wouldn't be any fungus or very little. And I discovered we moved into a hotspot. Down in Victoria and Tasmania, the fungus mainly comes along in autumn.
Right.
Which I think it does in most temperate climates.
Yeah.
But here in the subtropics, you get the fungus in summer, and we're in the subtropics, so we're the joining of the tropics and the temperate climates, so we get both. We get fungus in summer, we get fungus in autumn, and in spring.
Yeah, so that's kind of a long forage season you have there, it sounds like. You guys are lucky.
It's quite patchy. It depends on the rain. If there's no rain, there's no fungus.
Yeah.
And on the temperature and all sorts of things. I wish I understood all of them, but sometimes I can go out and I think, oh, there should be lots of fungus. And I get out there and there's not one, nothing. Another time I'll go out and think, oh, probably not going to be very many, and they're all over the place. So wish I could understand better.
You know, with someone like yourself who's so prolific at finding mushrooms, you tend to think you're tapped into the mycelium somehow and you have a special connection with the mushrooms. The rest of us don't. But it's interesting to hear that for you, there is still a lot of mystery, still kind of a process of getting out there enough to find more amazing mushrooms.
Yeah. The more often I go out, the more often I'll find fungi. If it rains, you're more likely to get mushrooms coming up. And they're temperature dependent as well. So depending on the temperature. But there's also things like winds, which, it's partly drying. If you've got a drying wind, you won't get terribly many fungus. I try and figure it out, but I get little bits.
And then what are some of the mushrooms that you find there in Australia? And maybe just, highlights of a couple of your favorites.
Well, one of the favorites is a Tasmanian fungi called Mycena interrupta, which is a tiny little blue mushroom. But it's a beautiful blue. It's very dark blue in the center, going to a light blue on the outside. I'm always excited when I find it. It can be quite common sometimes, but that's a very beautiful one. There's a local one that I've found just around where I live, which has been in the process of being named for about 10 years. It still hasn't got an official name. We're hoping that it will happen fairly soon. But that's so blue that it's it looks like it's artificial. It looks like a bit of plastic, something like that. There's several others. The luminous mushrooms, Mycena chlorophos, are always a buzz to find. So there's quite a few. And then there's the starfish stinkhorn. You know the stinkhorns. Sniff them out.
The pungent aroma will lead you right to them.
That's another Australian one, which is spread all around the world, I believe. People thought that it originally spread on the boots of soldiers in the First World War.
That's a vivid historical story I never heard of. I love that. Is there much of a tradition of mushroom hunting or a relationship with fungi? You know, whether that's kind of indigenous Australia or non-indigenous, kind of later European settlers in Australia, any relationship with mushrooms? Any kind of cultural lineage of having an appreciation for mushrooms?
We're generally thought to be a fungiphobic society. Mm. We only eat a very limited number of mushrooms, about a half a dozen for most people. Well, most people would only eat one type. And if you don't buy it in a supermarket, you don't know what it is. So,
right.
In contrast to a place like Yunnan, where they eat 900 species of fungus.
Wow, yeah.
They just know lots about fungus.
And what was it that made you leave the beautiful shores of Tasmania, you know, leave your comfortable stomping grounds there to start exploring and then traveling the world, searching for different mushrooms? What was that call to adventure?
Well, the moment was when I got an email from Professor Peter Mortimer at Kunming Institute of Botany inviting me to Yunnan to photograph their mushrooms.
That was a pretty clear-cut moment.
Yeah, well, when you get an email out of the blue, someone inviting you to Yunnan, I wasn't quite sure of it to start with because it's one of these things where you've got to turn up and then you've got to trust they'll look after you. Packed our bags. So Catherine and myself went across to Yunnan and photographed mushrooms for a month.
Well, it sounds like that first trip to Yunnan was something kind of unexpected. I mean, you were posting pictures online and connecting with that digital community, but you weren't really trying to get picked up as a fungal photographer per se, it sounds like.
No, well, I've never gone out with any objective of selling the photographs or making money out of them.
Right.
Well, it's not quite true. I did some years back, I decided to do New Year's resolutions. What do you want to happen in the next year? And I remember saying that I'd like the mushrooms to at least pay for some of the photographic gear that I needed to buy and to pay for some of our travel. And in that year, they started to pay for quite a lot of our travel and pay for the photographic gear, because that's when I was offered ambassadorship for Sony Australia.
Well, the mushrooms answered that resolution, that intention that you set with the universe.
Yes, in a way they did.
They listened and they answered. And on this trip to Yunnan, obviously you're going to a place that's full of fungal diversity, a culture that has a real appreciation for mushrooms. But were there any mushrooms that stand out where you really had to stop and kind of take a breath that you were kind of blown away by? Were there any people that were absolutely incredible? Maybe any other stories about that first trip to Yunnan?
Well, I think it was just the sheer variety of mushrooms, just the quantity of mushrooms. And mycology friends in Yunnan told us when they go on these field trips, they collect all the mushrooms. So all of the mushrooms that I've got photographed in Yunnan have been collected and DNA sequenced.
Yeah.
And they say that 1 in 7 mushrooms that they collect is new to science.
Wow.
Year in, year out. They'll go back to the same place again. They'll collect mushrooms that they don't know, and 1 in 7 of them is new to science.
That's absurd. That is an incredible amount of biodiversity.
It is. I think if you did the same thing in Australia, you'd find the same sort of thing. Because a lot of our mushrooms, and even in North America, I believe the same thing, that they'll get a mushroom and say, that looks like a European mushroom with this name.
Of course.
So everyone thinks it is. No one bothers to do a DNA sequence on it. But if they did DNA sequence it, they could very well find, it looks the same, but it's actually a different species.
So you think we're probably on the tip of the iceberg when it comes to mapping out the true fungal diversity, maybe even worldwide?
Well, it's thought that there might be, say, 4 million species of fungus on the planet, and we've documented 200,000 so far.
So a long way to go. So a lot more chances for all of us to keep our eyes peeled and discover new mushrooms and new fungi. In your travels, did you discover any mushrooms that were new to science? You know, is there a Mycena exfordii out there?
No, there's a Panaeolus exfordii, which oddly enough is a hallucinogenic mushroom.
I don't know if we can make any inferences about Steve based on that, but.
No, I don't think you can, in fact. It just happened to be a hallucinogenic mushroom.
And where was that discovered?
In the lawns in the Kunming Institute of Botany in Kunming.
Then you've taken multiple trips back to China, it sounds like. And so that first trip must have gone well. And then you decided that this was something you really had a passion for, was going around and documenting fungi around the planet.
If you sell fungi photographs, okay, you know, someone give you some money for it, which is a bit of a thrill, I suppose, but it's not very lasting. But if you go on a trip and explore that, we first two trips we went to Nabunhe down near the Mekong River.
Yeah.
Then the next trip we went to a place called Amoshan. And I think if you look up Amoshan on Google, you won't find it.
Yeah, I've certainly never heard of it.
No one has. It's right next to the Vietnam border. People who travel a lot may have heard of a place called Sapa in Vietnam.
Okay.
They go on treks and things. This is over the Chinese side. Very remote. No tourists. Tourists aren't allowed there. So we went through there, and then the last time we went to a place called Alaoshan, which is in central Yunnan. So each time we go to a different place, we may go back again next year and we'll go somewhere else. You get to explore places that tourists just don't see. The accommodation isn't always great because there are no hotels either.
Right. Well, I'm sure there is a thrill in that, though, finding places that are off the beaten trail, really sounds like off the map. And then you're kind of investigating these organisms that are off the beaten trail, really, for most people, are off the map. So that must create a lot of enjoyment and excitement on these trips as you're going on adventures, expeditions into the unknown, exploring the unexplored.
It really is the highlight of the mushroom adventure. And there are a lot of highlights. We've gone to Yunnan in China, Thailand, Myanmar, Northeast India, Nepal. So we've concentrated on a region known as the Eastern Himalayas.
Okay.
Which is a fascinating region, geologically really active. You know, it's moving now. Lots of the scenery is very new and it's been thrust up by the Himalayas. Well, thrust up by India, in fact, running into Asia.
And a really interesting mix of cultures, it seems like. That blend of Chinese, Indian, and Tibetan influence.
Yeah, it's one of the most diverse areas in the world. The hill tribe peoples there, the lowland people, a vast number of tribes. So in Yunnan, it's very ethnically diverse. Northern Thailand, it is as well. Burma or Myanmar, and all the way across. It's a very diverse, ethnically, a fascinating area.
Just so we can live a little vicariously on these amazing adventures that you take, what's the kit or equipment that you put together for the trip? And then what kind of team do you have to put together that makes the trip happen and really makes the trip successful?
We're part of the team. We don't organize these trips. We do to an extent when we go to new places like Nepal and Northeast India, but essentially we allow the local NGO or university to organize it, and we go along to assist with the documentation. We take a lot of film gear along.
Yeah.
So we've got enough to do video and all, there's my still photography gear. There's the video gear that Catherine takes. We max out our luggage allowance. We managed to get by with 30 kilograms each. 20 kilograms is photographic gear and 10 kilograms left for clothing and personal stuff.
Well, it sounds like then you've upgraded pretty significantly from that 2-megapixel digital camera you started with to some far more serious documenting equipment. Now, if you can share some of the photographic secrets of Stephen Axford without giving too much away, what advice can you give us to all take better pictures of mushrooms and take pictures of mushrooms that would really be of that caliber that is useful for science, maybe useful for NGOs, useful for groups that may need to document fungal diversity? What secrets can you share with us?
For people to identify fungi, they want to be able to see the underneath and the top, so both top and underneath the fungus. Often you can take a photograph that shows both at the same time, which is ideal. You need to get some light underneath the fungus. I use a reflector, which is a little piece of aluminium foil. Very easy. Shove it in your pocket. Just take it out because it's macro photography. So a reflector only needs to be a couple of inches, maybe 6 inches or something. You put the foil underneath the mushroom, out of frame of the picture, of course. And you'll always need a tripod to keep the camera steady because they're long exposure. Usually they're sort of 2-4 seconds, this sort of thing. You never want it in sunlight. So the best time for mushroom photography is when it's overcast. We get the best pictures when it's raining, but it's not very good for the cameras.
Right.
The gear I use is Sony, and I'm currently using a Sony A7R4, which is a 60 megapixel camera. It's great for me. The high resolution cameras take a little bit more work in setting it up because they're slightly less forgiving. It's easier to blur things because you've got so much resolution. But certainly it's something, a 20 megapixel camera or better, preferably, well, I'd always use a full frame camera because particularly in low light, they take better pictures. But you can probably get away with, you know, not full frame cameras nowadays. The light sensitivity tends to be a bit better.
You know, acquiring all of this professional grade photographic equipment, honing your craft as a photographer, was that something that all came hand in hand with this relationship with fungi? I mean, were you an avid amateur photographer or anything before all this started? Or was this purely because of your explorations into the world of mushrooms?
Well, I was never a photographer at all before 2000. I took a few family photos and that sort of thing, but nothing much. Never really understood it. Only with digital cameras that I started to understand it. Mushrooms weren't the only thing I used to, and I still do. I take photographs of wildlife and scenery and things like this. It's all out in the bush. I'm not really into city photography at all.
Yeah, nature has so much beauty to capture. It's kind of a limitless palette to work with. And then when did you become this big icon in fungal photography? I mean, was it a certain set of photographs that caught fire? Was it a certain feature in a documentary or a website? When did this ascent into superstardom happen for you?
Three things happened. The first one, I just got this email from a mob called This Is Colossal. It's sort of an art photography blog, and they sent me an email saying, can we feature you on our blog? I said, yeah, sure, go for it. Yeah, the photos are there, just use them. I didn't really think very much about it because I remember I was on this site called Webshots. It doesn't operate anymore, I don't think, and I'd had 6 million hits on Webshots.
Wow. Okay.
Various photos, but it never did anything for me. You know, no one, I had one or two educational books printed my pictures, but really nothing. But when This Is Colossal did a feature on my mushroom photographs, all of a sudden, all of these magazines across Europe and North America and Japan even sent me emails asking if they could use my photographs. So, and apparently This Is Colossal. Yeah, it's probably got a couple hundred thousand people follow it, but it's very influential. Lots of the other blogs like Bored Panda and so on just directly copy from This Is Colossal and use their blogs.
Right.
And all the magazines, you know, they subscribe to it when they see something. They go, oh, we'll do a feature on this. So there was that, and then the BBC, within the next year, I think, sent me an email inquiring about the luminous fungi.
That's one that always sets people's imaginations alight.
Still does.
Yeah.
And eventually I sent them some of my first time-lapse, and they loved them, and then had the luminous fungi plus a whole lot of other fungi went on planet Earth too. And then I got invited to Yunnan. So that was all within a year or two. So it wasn't particular photographs. It was just an accumulation of people discovering me, I guess.
man, a pretty seminal 12 to 24 month period, it sounds like, where everyone became a huge fan of Steve Axford. I know you were doing this long before that, and then suddenly, you know, that big moment happens and everyone wants you to be part of a documentary or showcase your work. It's really amazing. And now when it comes to time-lapse photography, I think for anyone who's seen that mushroom time-lapse kind of visual effect, it's so vivid, it's so powerful, and especially with mushrooms, because they are so ephemeral, you know, it's hard to even find them in full, beautiful fruiting stage, much less seeing that entire growth stage. Obviously, none of us get to see it from that whole growth stage like you do in a time-lapse. And I guess that kind of is true with all natural phenomena, but mushrooms in particular seem perfect for time-lapse photography. But how did you get into time-lapse? You know, and how did you develop your skills at doing these time-lapse photos and visual effects?
Time-lapse was first a suggestion of my partner, Catherine. It's Catherine Marciniak. And she just asked me, have you ever done any time-lapse? And I said, no. And she hadn't either. So we went up to a nearby lookout called the Pinnacles, and it overlooks Mount Warning, which is an old volcano, and set up our cameras there. And I think we had one intervalometer. And so the other camera, I'm just sitting there with and pressing the shutter every minute or two or every 30 seconds or something. And we got a storm coming in across the mountain, and then it came straight across the top of us. So we go from bright sunshine to in the middle of a cloud. And then we look down and there's a rainbow forming below us. We got this and we thought, well, this was easy, wasn't it? One of those things you'll try a dozen times and you won't get a view like that. Then I came back home and I'd recently discovered the luminous fungi around here. And thought, well, why not bring it inside? And we had a spare shower, so I put logs in the shower and blacked out the windows and made it a dark room. So we had rotting logs in this spare shower, and I decided to take some time lapse of that. And that didn't work perfectly because batteries would run out. You'd have to change batteries and so on. And any slight movement of the camera would muck you up. But they were reasonably successful and certainly showed what should be possible to do.
Well, and I'll point out that you are truly blessed to have a partner that is okay with you bringing rotting logs into the spare shower, turning it into a dark room and a photography photo booth.
I guess, can you speak to that a little bit, how Catherine has influenced your work? I mean, that's a pretty powerful story, her turning you on to something like time-lapse. But how has she helped the growth of your work and influenced your work?
Oh, it's immeasurable, really. You combine, you know, I'm a still photographer and quite technical, I suppose. And she's a documentary filmmaker and knows much more about storytelling and things like this. So the combination of the two, I guess the fungi still photography would probably have happened.
Right.
But a lot of the other stuff, no, it wouldn't have. I would have been invited over to Yunnan, whether we would have been formed such a strong relationship, because now we make videos and there's a combination. So they get a complete package with the two of us. There's still photographs, the time lapse, the videos, storytelling, and all of this come as one unit, which I certainly couldn't do by myself.
You know, I always admire partnerships like that, that can give to each other and build something better even than what they could do individually. And it really shows up in your work. I felt like there must be some kind of power behind the Axford throne, if you will.
No, it's all me.
Yeah, when we were communicating over email, I realized how involved Catherine was and thought she must have been the one to propel this to the next level, from just macro photography to now time-lapse and amazing documentaries. It all starts coming together in my head. And you just brought up Yunnan again. I have to know what it was like for you to interface with other cultures as you're developing your relationship with mushrooms. You know, what kind of perspectives and insights do you think that brought to your appreciation of kingdom fungi?
Well, it makes you realize how big the whole thing around fungi and people has always been. Catherine likes to call it, I think, ethnomycology.
Yes, of course.
Where we look at the way the people interact with the fungus. You know, in Yunnan, I photograph the fungi, and I'm sure I take fairly good pictures of the fungus, but all of the stuff that's looking at the way the people interact with it is essentially done by Catherine.
Okay.
So we'll go out into tribal areas and go with someone to show us what mushrooms they eat, how they collect them, where they go to collect them, because they eat an incredible variety. I don't really like eating mushrooms in Australia because most of the mushrooms are fairly uninteresting and they upset my stomach in general. But in China, there was really nice tasting mushrooms that had a beautiful texture and were just way and above what I'm used to eating in Australia.
Right. And I think that might help explain why there's such a mycophilic culture, whilst somewhere like Australia is a mycophobic culture. I think it helps when you have hundreds of amazing mushrooms to eat.
Yeah. We've done a fair bit of work now on poisonous mushrooms as well. It's mainly in trying to document them. I'd never really paid much attention before, but say in Myanmar and in eastern India, they were worried because people would eat poisonous mushrooms occasionally and would kill people, which is bad. But perhaps even worse is it put a lot of people off eating mushrooms entirely.
Hmm.
So we've concentrated on that a little bit. We've been taught to avoid eating amanitas completely, even though some amanitas are quite edible. It's just that almost all of the fatalities in the world are caused by amanitas.
You know, I think that is a pretty safe rule of thumb for almost any forager out there, is to avoid that amanita family entirely, just because there are so many mistakes you can make in identification. As I say that, I'm hearing in the back of my head voices of foragers saying, don't discriminate against amanita. There are amazing edible amanita. But, you know, for everyone but the most expert foragers, when you see that egg-shaped base and you see that veil and those distinctive features of an amanita, I think you got to set that one to the side. But what we're getting at here is actually one of the key themes in the newest documentary, Planet Fungi, and that is exploring the toxicity of mushrooms, because it sounds like some of these government groups, some of these social groups want to clarify what's toxic and what's edible so people don't get scared and put off from mushrooms, because they could be a really important food source. And it sounds like mushrooms could be actually a really important protein source for many parts of the world.
Yes, well, in eastern India, they looked at it and found that, you know, the basic diet was lentils, and lentils are lacking in certain amino acids.
Right.
Which they can get from fungus.
Yeah.
We worked with people who were just starting to grow fungus or to produce the spawn for fungus, which they'd give to the villagers to grow. And the villagers were, you know, compared to working in the tea plantations, they could get the same money with just a couple of hours work a day. It's very good for them. It's a good source of protein and a good source of money. Hopefully they'll start doing it. We were doing the same sort of thing in Myanmar, in Chin State, setting up mushroom farming there.
And fungi do seem like this incredible untapped resource as, you know, a nutrition source of cheap available protein, and then as an economic force to help people who are growing mushrooms get more economic security. And that is really highlighted in the documentary. So Planet Fungi, you travel around, I believe, the Assam region of India, and you were gracious enough to let us have a sneak preview of the documentary.
And it is absolutely incredible to be able to vicariously travel, especially in the era of COVID, to be able to go travel with yourself and Catherine and experience all these amazing towns and these rich cultures and, of course, incredible mushrooms. One of the things that really struck me, though, about the documentary is there wasn't a lot of knowledge when it came to mushrooms.
No, I suspect that the tribal people there originally had more knowledge, but everything's been pretty fragmented and a lot of the basic knowledge has been lost over, you know, hundreds of years, I guess.
Right.
Assam itself, they don't eat very many mushrooms at all. We spent quite a bit of time in Meghalaya, which is just to the south of Assam, and it's the wettest place on earth, according to the Guinness Book of Records.
Hold on, that's insane. Because you have places in Southeast Asia where it's tsunamis and a massive amount of rainfall. You have cloud forests in South America. So to claim that title, it must be absolutely drenched all the time there.
Well, they get, in one place we went to, they get nearly 12 meters of rain a year, something over 40 feet.
I mean, that's mind-blowing. Hard to even conceptualize that much moisture.
Yeah, and we, of course, go there in the wet season. They have about 4 months of wet, so they get basically 12 meters of rain in those 4 months. A lot of Meghalaya is actually quite hilly. It's right next to, just to the north of Bangladesh. So right. The monsoon comes in across the flatlands. It hits the mountains in Meghalaya, which are about 2,000 meters, and dumps all the rain.
And what was the inspiration behind the documentary? You know, was it an NGO or an academic group that reached out to you to come document fungal diversity? And then why did you guys decide to do a full documentary instead of just, you know, a series of photos or something like that?
Well, we were invited to India to help them document the fungus. When we got there, we realized that we weren't going to have a mycologist with us. We were going to be the experts, close as you could to the experts. It was an exploratory trip, I guess.
Yeah.
But we decided that when we got there that maybe we could do something useful in making a documentary of what we did while we were there. So we just started, or Catherine, essentially, because I'm not a filmmaker. Catherine started filming bits. I'd film occasional bits as well. But we just collected all this material and put it together. We had to add we went back again the next year. So that was last year. And okay. We added a few more bits to it. You know, we were lucky. We were some of the characters that we had in the film.
We were introduced to a lot of really fascinating characters, powerful humans. But our favorite was probably Kong, because she was eccentric and verbose and really expressive and just seemed like a fun person to be around. I'm going to guess anyone who watches the documentary will fall in love with her like we did. What was it like for you, though, meeting Kong? What was it like spending time with her? Tell us a little bit more about her.
Well, Kong means sister in Khazi, Khazi being one of the major ethnic groups in Meghalaya. So she was just introduced to us as sister, Kong. We got to know her as Kong. She could speak no English at all, but we just didn't have any trouble understanding her. As you'd see from the film, when she described being poisoned by a mushroom, you had no doubt she was describing being poisoned by a mushroom.
Definitely no translator needed.
We got to know her quite well because we went out on several occasions that year and then again last year. And last year we took back a pre-cut of the film because we added a few bits later, but we showed it to her and she was very pleased. It was great going along to her home and all her extended family, and they were all very proud of her and she was very, very pleased. So oh, that's, it was great.
Yeah, she was terrific. And then there was another gentleman that we got introduced to in India who was famous for replanting an entire forest.
Yes, that was, I've forgotten his name. He lives on Majuli Island, which is the largest river island in the world. It's in the Brahmaputra. And one year he saw that they had this big flood and all these snakes were washed up on the sandbanks. And then they died in the sun. And he was quite upset about that and tried to find out what he could do. And people told him that he needed to plant grass, bamboo in other words, big grass, and reforest the area. So he started doing this, I think, about 30 years ago. He's now working, I think, on 700 hectares to rebuild the forest there, because it's all, you know, it was all logged and all washed away, so it was just sandbank. So he replanted the forest, and now there are trees, must be a meter and a half, 2 meters in diameter.
Wow.
It's just a phenomenal thing that what one person can do. You know, I've got my property here, which is about 3 hectares, so about 8 acres, I think. And I've replanted most of it. It's only been 10 years, but the difference between what it was like when I started and what it's like now is phenomenal.
Well, and it's nice to inspire that kind of hope. You know, all of us have that awareness of environmental damage and seeing the issues that we face on that front as a collective society. And it's really inspiring then to see those stories where a single person can have such a dramatic impact on improving the environmental conditions, the ecology, making new havens for biodiversity, essentially, because he was talking about he's growing the grass and then the insects come back and then the snakes. And he was building this food web back. And, you know, it struck me that that gentleman and Kong were so emotive and eccentric. And those were your mushroom experts on site. And I kind of found echoes of that with all the mushroom clubs and societies that I'm used to here in North America. And maybe it's just eccentric and expressive people are drawn to fungi.
Yeah, it's very easy to, when I started photographing fungus, I knew virtually nothing about them. They were pretty. And I was noticing the variety, and then you meet mycologists and gradually the knowledge builds up. Every bit you learn, you realize there's so much more that no one understands. We don't understand the individual species, let alone understand how they interact with other things.
Yeah, I mean, complex relationships and symbioses abound. And when it comes to the world of fungi, it becomes almost impossible to tease them apart from other organisms because they're so intertwined with them.
Yeah, and fungus changes what it does. There's one very pretty little fungus that grows around here. It's a little red cup fungus. We call it retro chairs because it looks like the chairs from the 1960s.
Okay, retro chairs. I'm taking that name. I love it.
That will grow inside the cellular structure of a rainforest tree leaf. Spends maybe part of its life there, but then if the leaf falls to the ground or the twig falls to the ground, then it will change into a macrofungus and form these beautiful Philipsia subpurpurea, I think is the name of it.
Gains function.
Yeah, and it's not like the metamorphosis of an insect where it starts off in one form and ends its life in another form. It can change from one to the other, just what happens to suit it.
Yeah.
We're only just starting to realize this about fungus, that a lot of them have many different forms depending on where they are and what the situation is.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of recently, I was getting familiarized with the work of George Carroll at the University of Oregon, who had this theory about the foraging ascomycete or the foraging endophyte. And it's this idea that these fungi do hide in a certain form in the leaves of the trees, especially in tropical and subtropical regions, because the leaves don't fall as frequently as they do in temperate regions. So they're able to thrive in that habitat. But then once those leaves fall, they kind of blossom into another form where they're able to activate some saprobic capabilities, and they kind of shapeshift to be able to break down leaf litter and adapt to this new environment. But then, like you're saying, it's so hard to know what's true and what's not. There's no clear-cut delineation between these forms. And in that example of this foraging ascomycete, it was difficult for them to even set up an experiment to try to get any answers. So yeah, mystery, complex relationships abound. Mushrooms are shapeshifters and enigmatic creatures. But on the photographic side, are there any particular macro fungi that you really love getting pictures of? And then as a two-parter, are there any mushrooms that have eluded you that you really want to photograph that have been on your radar?
I just keep finding more and more and more. So it's not a matter of looking through books and saying, aha, I want to find that one. It's really going out and finding them, saying, I've never seen anything like this in a book before. You know, I've been posting photographs on Instagram recently. I posted a blue entoloma. I had it written down as being Entoloma eugenii. And I'd never really paid much attention to it. And then someone said, you know, where can you find this? So I looked up where you could find it. And apparently this is an extremely rare fungus found in Siberia, Japan, and Korea.
Hmm.
And yet I've got photographs of it from Yunnan and from Thailand. And according to the literature, it's not found there.
Right. Yeah, well, in many cases, the literature is pretty new and we're still discovering so much. Names, everything is changing all the time.
In Yunnan, I found this little hygrosity, mauve-colored, which was thought to be cool temperate. And we found it in Amashan, near the Vietnam border in Yunnan. So all the time I keep, and there was another one which was quite rare, which was a Coquina incititia, which I'd found in Australia, which I was quite excited about. And then when we went over to China, found it in Yunnan, in Amashan again. So it's not a matter of searching in books and saying, I want to find that. It's a matter of going out there and looking at what you found.
I like that approach, as being ready to just be in awe of what you find and be open to whatever comes your way.
Yeah, because quite often I'll post things on the internet and other people get quite excited about them because I've discovered something usually not unknown, because if it's unknown, no one's going to know.
Right.
They usually pass by with no comment. When you've got something that's listed as being extremely rare and been found once somewhere or other and you find it again somewhere else, people can get quite excited by it.
What's that been like for you entering the social media sphere? Because, you know, you started not that long ago and already you have this tremendous following, which makes sense. Your pictures are absolutely incredible. What's that been like interacting with this social media mycophile community? Because that's where my channel started and kind of where everything I do started, on Instagram. So what's that been like for you?
It's been good, because when you take photographs, it always seems a pity when they just get filed away and no one looks at them.
Right.
I started with Instagram. We wanted to get a bit of a following so we could advertise the film, because it costs us a little bit of money to make this film because no one's supporting us. So we thought, oh, we'll try and sell it. And to sell it, you've got to get a following. So went on to Instagram and I thought, I'll post 4 or 5 mushrooms a day and see how it goes. And we've built up 23,000 followers so far. And at that rate, and it keeps going up by about 300 a day. I've got a selection of about 1,000 of my best photos, and I'm just posting them each day. It's quite a lot of work. I can understand how people who, you know, these so-called influencers on social media, must be totally consuming to do this in a where you're interacting with people all the time and you've got multiple platforms and things. I can't understand. It'd drive you mad, I think.
I think so. I try to limit my use a little bit to, you know, put the word out there and use it, but there are times where it's helpful to disconnect for your own sanity.
But it is good because it's nice to, I'm often surprised. I'll post a photograph and I think, oh, it's all right, I suppose, but not very good. And people love it.
Yeah. You know,
blue entoloma, the first one I posted, I was sort of tossing up whether I'd posted it or not. And I posted it and it's, I don't know, I think it's had about 4,000 likes.
There is something gratifying. As much as we know, it's just that dopamine hit of seeing a little heart come up on our screen. There's something gratifying about having people appreciate your work in a public forum. And there is such a massive, especially, you know, in the US right now, but I would imagine it might be the same in the UK and Australia, some of the Anglophile countries. There is this wave of growing interest in mushrooms. You know, obviously Eastern cultures have been well aware of for a long time. There's been a wave of inspiration and interest in these amazing organisms. So there's a thirst for the pictures and the information you're putting out there, I think.
Well, it's interesting because the Instagram shows you all these statistics.
Right.
And the city where there's most interest is Santiago in Chile.
Wow. Okay.
Followed by Melbourne, and then Sydney and Mexico City and New York.
Well, you have a much more international audience than I do, or most of the folks are in America, but I guess that makes sense. You know, you're naming some places. Chile is increasingly becoming more and more mycophilic, as we know, with the Fungi Foundation and the great work of Juliana. And obviously, Mexico has a rich heritage of mushrooms. So that makes some sense, I think.
I think Juliana is the main reason for San Diego.
I would have to believe so.
We did visit Chile once and spent quite a long time, a lot of time with Juliana. And I actually gave a presentation at San Diego University.
Yeah, she's someone I think who could convert anyone into a mushroom lover with her passion and knowledge.
Yeah, she's very special.
Now, another interesting topic that you sent over in your notes was the idea of fire fungi, where mushrooms and fungi recolonizing after fires. And you know, as we know, 2019 was one of those brutal, maybe the most brutal wildfire year ever in Australia. You know, with everything, all the calamity that's happened in 2020, we almost forget that much of Australia was on fire for months there. What is the relationship there between fire and fungi, and what are you learning after that massive wildfire season about fungal recolonization after an event like that?
We'd heard about fire after fungi quite a few times, but you know, it's not often that you go out into areas that have recently been burnt. You tend to keep away from them.
Right.
But this year we decided to go out because the fires, they'd been about as bad as certainly the worst fires in New South Wales for quite a long time. And they covered the whole of the eastern side of Australia. We went out to some local ones. They're about 20 kilometres from here. And they'd burnt the rainforest, which is very unusual. Part of the definition of rainforest is it doesn't burn.
Shouldn't be able to burn, right?
Yeah. So we went out there and we started looking for the fungus after fire. And there was lots of it. This fungus called stonemaker fungus, which is quite a large mushroom, I guess, you know, about 6 inches across, maybe more. And it comes up from a mycelial mass underground, and it will only fruit after fire, come up while the ground's still smoking, still hot. You get these mushrooms popping up all over the place.
Wow.
So in the area we were photographing, they hadn't had a fire for 100 years. So the mushroom hadn't fruited for 100 years.
That's incredible. A true fire fungus. I mean, the most fire obligate fungus I've ever heard of, where it has to be still smoking or hot.
Well, there were other fungus that were even more interesting in a way, because that one, you could see the mycelial, it would grow. Obviously, the mycelium would grow when there was no fire. It would just fruit when there was fire.
Right.
There was this other fungus, this tiny cup fungus, which matted the surface of the ground, which on some research we found No one really knows how it survives outside the fire because it doesn't grow when there's no fire. So what was it doing? There was some fungus, a similar sort of fungus in North America, which someone had found was growing in the cellular structure of moss.
Oh, okay.
Then the fire came along and somehow it transferred to the soil and grew in a different form, that it would grow in sterilized soil. Like some local person here said, oh, yeah, he worked in a tea tree farm. They make tea tree oil.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut the trees and then they'd steam the oil out of them so the residue would be sterilized and they'd throw that in a heap and those mushrooms would grow there.
Makes sense in a way, because if you're growing mushrooms on a farm or in any kind of lab setting, you would sterilize your substrate. So I guess you're getting rid of the competition.
Yeah. You know, it's got virgin territory.
Yeah.
There was another one that we found. You know, there's a lot of logs, you know, trees falling over in the forest. And when that burns, you get a charcoal bed.
Mm.
Maybe big pieces of charcoal with hollows underneath. And if you lift those up, we'd find little mushrooms, little white mushrooms growing underneath in the hottest part of the fire. So it would have been totally sterilized. You'd have to ask the question, what happened? How did they get there?
Right. If they needed fire, how could they have made it there in the first place?
Lots of questions there for people to answer.
You know, I pray that there won't ever be another event like that to be able to research this further, but maybe people can, you know, do controlled environments and things with cultures of these fungi, start to unlock some of the secrets, because they almost sound like extremophiles, you know, those organisms, those microscopic organisms that can live in even the most harsh, unforgiving environments where no life can live. I mean, these are approaching that with some of the heat and the burning and the conditions around them in which they're growing. So that's really interesting. And I know there are people doing research on fungi's role in recolonizing after burns to aerate the soil and allow water back in. And so I think there's a lot of relationships between fire and then the resurgence of fungi afterwards that are one of the frontiers in studying fungi.
Well, some of the cup fungus that I mentioned, it very clearly bound the soil together, so the soil was quite firm because soil after a fire, it washes away or blows away very easily. It's very fine and crumbly.
Right.
But if you get this fungus on it, it locks the surface of the soil together. The patches we found, if you dug in underneath them, the soil was relatively moist, but in areas there wasn't any fungus, the soil was dry. They'd had a little bit of rain there, but it locked the moisture in. It seems likely that it's very important for the recovery of the rainforest after fire, or the forest in general, because fire is very common in Australia. It's, you know, eucalypt forests rely on fire for germinating new trees. So all the eucalypt forests in Australia are fire prone.
Well, and the question then remains too, you know, once we study these interactions and start understanding that recolonization, will there be a way to apply that? Or, you know, will it just be understanding this natural system just to know how it operates? Or will there be some way to inoculate areas after fire with certain strains of fungi that can help recolonize? As far as I know, we're not quite there yet, but it gets your mind going in a lot of different interesting potentials, especially when you're faced with a disaster like you guys experienced in 2019. You have to wonder, man, can we leverage some of this knowledge of fungi to help restore some of these environments?
Well, I'm sure we can. The question to start with is we need to understand what happens.
Right.
We're just getting started with that understanding, but we are getting started with it. We do understand that the fungus is very important. But just how it, because all of these things are interactions between different life forms. You know,
yeah.
You go back not that far, in fact, and people would just study a single life form and assume that it was happening by itself, whereas pretty well nothing does. You know, we certainly can't live by ourselves. You look at our gut microbiome. Without that, we're dead.
Yeah, I've often heard that funny statistic or adage, I guess, about the fact that there are more non-human cells in the human body than human cells.
Yeah.
There's part of that that gets so complicated that it kind of forces you to be okay with realizing you're not going to understand it all, which I think a lot of people who get into mushrooms and fungi come to that understanding pretty quickly. So yeah, as not to feel overwhelmed, you start to realize there's no way I'm ever going to understand all of this. So
we just scratch the surface a little bit. Understanding that you don't understand is a step in itself.
It absolutely is. And it helps you kind of loose some of the pressure and just follow what you're passionate about, follow what interests you, where things lead. And, you know, that's as good as any path to follow into the unknowable. And I guess this is more of a general question. I don't want to pick a topic that's too sensitive. Do you think this process of foraging for fungi and developing this passion for photography, do you think that helped you process some of the kind of emotional trauma you had during that hard period of your life, you know, where you lost someone you loved, you had your own bout with illness? Do you think this was a key element in helping your road to recovery, both mental, but also, you know, emotionally and spiritually? Do you think this really helped with that recovery, this developing of a relationship with fungi and mushrooms?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to have an interest in life, a passion in life. So, you know, it just became my coping strategy, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, built into much more than that because I really liked it. So I could go out. Initially, it was just going out into the bush, and I'd walk for 20 or 30 kilometers down remote tracks, or not even tracks. I think sometimes I got a little bit too daring, but I'd sometimes wonder what would happen if I got bitten by a snake down at the end outside mobile phone range and 20 kilometers from anywhere.
It's the fear of any forager. What happens if you fall or, yeah, get bitten? I guess in Australia, you have to worry about all kinds of venomous things when you're too far out there, yeah?
Yeah, well, I read a report in Italy, it's probably 15 years back now. They had one season, people were going out searching for mushrooms, and I think there was about 20 people killed in the space of a week, not by eating poisonous mushrooms, but falling off cliffs.
Oh, my.
Porcinis or something like that were growing in remote locations, and these people kept stumbling and falling down cliffs. 20 of them, though.
That seems almost more like coincidence. I wonder if there wasn't a porcini right at the very edge or something like that.
Pick me.
Yeah.
I was in Wonderland.
Right. But, you know, as I talk with more and more people and hear how this relationship with nature and fungi being a way to get out into nature more, it seems like it's a really effective tool to deal with things that pharmaceuticals are kind of the only answer we have in a lot of different societies. And it feels like this is another tool that can help process some of these things that are difficult to process. And at the end of it, you're developing a passion for something that's incredibly interesting.
Well, you've just got to, you know, you've gone through something like that. You've got a hole in your life. You need to fill it with something else. And that was my strategy, was what the hell am I going to do with my life? So I had to find something that really turned me on. Then, you know, I could go out and I'd plan the weekends and I'd go out into the bush or I'd travel overseas. And it became all encompassing. I never imagined what, you know, I just thought it was a hobby for a while. But it turned into something much more than that.
Yeah, so you got completely inoculated and now you are inseparable from the mushrooms. And then another, you know, more personal question, but was Catherine interested in fungi or mushrooms at all? Or is this a world that you got to introduce her to?
I think that I probably introduced her to mushrooms. Oh, yeah, she obviously knew about them before, but there wasn't any
There weren't a lot of people passionate about mushrooms when I started, I don't think. There were a few people that took photographs and the international community, but it's really blossomed as the internet's grown. That now we have friends all over the world. And if you add up all the people in the world who are interested in mushrooms, we're quite a big community.
Yeah.
If you add up the people in your local town who are interested in mushrooms, and well, you might be the only one.
I just wondered about that because I've gotten a lot from showing my partner, introducing her to this whole kingdom of organisms that I'm so obsessed with, and seeing her kind of have that same realization. So I wondered if you got a little bit of that process too, and kind of showing Catherine what you're passionate about.
Well, it happens with all sorts of people. We go over to, you know, as I've said, India and Nepal, and you go over there, and the people that we deal with, they often understand a lot about the botany, but almost nothing about mushrooms. And just as we go through the forests and we're finding different mushrooms, and the realization comes to them at how much they've been missing, and they, you know, instead of looking up at the trees all the time, they're looking down at their feet, and they get just as excited as we do in finding the mushrooms in the end.
Yeah, something uniquely satisfying about giving people that gift almost of getting excited and showing them an organism that's so vitally important to the place that they love. I mean, that must be uniquely satisfying for you to show them, you know, an environment that they love and they're trying to protect, to show them such a key part of it they might have been overlooking.
Yeah, and it's become both Catherine and my sort of objective in a way is educating people as to mushrooms, because it's something that I can do. The pictures do tend to turn people on. The photographs I took in Nepal last year, the NGO that we worked with, KTK Belt, they're called, and they took the photographs and were making, I think, 100 posters, each with one photograph of mushrooms to put around schools. The kids just love them. And if you can show the kids, you know, these grow in your forests, they'll go out into the forests and they start looking for mushrooms. And if they go out into the forests and start looking for mushrooms, they're going to get upset when someone comes along and wants to cut their forest down.
It's yes. Just little
things like that. You know, it just helps to preserve the forests.
Absolutely. People want to protect what they love and what they care about, what they're interested in. You have to show them and inspire them to care about and get interested. So it's amazing to hear that you're having that effect. And I think it also showed up in the documentary Planet Fungi with the gentleman who is the head of the group there in Assam that was working on conservation. And, you know, he talked about, you know, yeah, we're very interested in mushrooms for all of these economic reasons, food security and poison. And he's like, but we also just want to understand these amazing organisms. And he says, you know, I didn't know anything about them until Stephen came here, and now I want to know more. So I think that illustrates what you're talking about beautifully.
It really gives you it's more than just going out and taking pictures and enjoying yourself. You really feel as though you're adding something back, which is important.
I guess, when does the documentary officially release? When can people go watch this trip through India and learn about all the amazing mushrooms you find?
Well, officially, it'll come out in October now. There's always something else that we've got to add on. We had some feedback from Google and so on saying, oh, you've got to do this. So we're fixing that up now. Hopefully, you know, it's all completed. It's just the crossing the I's and dotting the T's, I guess.
Where can people find out about the film? When it's released, where are going to be the places people can watch it?
There's a website, planetfungi.movie, where you can see the trailer and express your interest. Anything to do with Planet Fungi, you've probably seen this as well. You start using a name, Planet Fungi, and then all sorts of other people start using.
Oh, yes. I'm sure you've had a lot of people on social media who start using the name Planet Fungi or Fungi Planet or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we put it on Instagram. Within a couple of weeks, there was about 10 other lookalikes. I'm not quite sure why people do it, but they do, so you can't do much about it.
Yeah, well, hopefully they aren't taking all your beautiful photographs and pretending they're their own, but there are ways to stop that. But planetfungi.movie, and then where can people find out more about your work? I mean, is Instagram, where again, it's planetfungi, however you want to say that, is that the best place to follow your work, or where else can people see more information about you?
Well, I do have a website called steveaxford.smugmug.com, SmugMug being a photo hosting site.
Got it. Okay.
And I think all of my photographs are on there. It's totally easy to navigate to a photograph if you want to find it. You could sit there and just look at photographs for hours and hours. I think I've got 10,000 photographs of mushrooms there. I haven't ever counted them, but lots of other things as well. Like on my property, we've got a platypus lives in the creek. I've got a short film on a platypus.
No way. How did I miss this? We'll have to go back and watch the film about the platypus, because we were scrolling through so many pictures of fungi. You know, we watched the documentary and then we just started, you know, it's a fun way to spend an afternoon or an evening, is just scrolling through all these amazing pictures of fungi. But how did I not see the platypus?
Well, if you search on platypus stalker, then it was on the ABC in Australia. It was just that Catherine suggested we make, years back when I was out there taking photographs of platypus. So she said, I'll take some video of them as well. So I took some video of the platypus. So we've got that. Of weird things like a magnificent spider, which is also called a bolas spider, because it catches its prey by dangling a thread with a sticky blob on the end, attracting moths through the pheromone, spinning the sticky thread around and around and snagging a moth with it, like bolas in Argentina.
You know, Australia has a reputation for being the land of all these incredibly weird and sometimes frightening creatures, both insects and animals.
Oh, we have quite a selection here. We have brown snakes that live around the house, which are reputed to be the second most deadly snake in the world.
And you're not scared. I mean, you're just comfortable with it at this point.
Well, I'm a bit wary of them, but you know, I was always taught when I was young, the only dangerous snake is the snake you can't see. Australian snakes aren't particularly aggressive. As long as you can see the snake, it's not really a problem for you.
And now what is coming up for you guys in the future? Obviously, we're in an era where a lot of things are in flux, especially for someone who travels a lot. The fate of travel is always up in the air. But what are some plans that you guys have for the future goals or projects?
Well, Catherine's got a film in Yunnan she's got most of the material already. We probably need to add a little bit. So Yunnan is probably the likely next one. We were going to do one in Mexico, but we had to cancel the trip to Mexico because of COVID.
Right.
Yeah, there's a possibility in Nepal. And we've got a couple of other plans. We thought about doing the grand tour. If we could go through Siberia, through Eastern Europe and so on.
Yeah.
But we've got to see what the opportunities are, really.
Right. You got to see what opportunities avail themselves. I said before the show, though, that, you know, I think this is such a great idea to have a documentary series showcasing fungi and fungal diversity in areas that a lot of us haven't heard of. Especially in Asia, where we all have kind of monolithic ideas of what India is or what China is. So to see some of these areas like this Assam region, that's a blend of all these interesting cultures, it really puts a lot of things in perspective, makes you see the world as this bigger place, and introduces you to mushrooms and cultures and ideas that we just didn't know about. So I think this is a great idea, and I hope you guys are able to make more documentaries with more areas, more unique mushrooms and people. And I think it's just a fantastic idea. That's kind of a clarion call for everyone to go out and support the documentary, watch it, spread it around. So we make sure that it gets traction and people pick up on this and there's an opportunity to make more of this kind of content, because I just loved it.
We love making it. And when I look at it, I go, well, when we see any other people look at it, they all love it. But we, you know, we tried to sell it to Netflix and Discovery Channel. And
sure,
when we got people to watch it, they all said they loved it. But where are we going to put it? It was a bit too left field for them. Just didn't fit into their categories. It wasn't quite a Game of Thrones.
Yeah, you'd have to change the script pretty significantly to make that into a Game of Thrones. But you've got some great characters already. So,
well, but you need a famous person. You know, we haven't got a star there, have we?
There is something very special about it, and I do hope that maybe it's genre defining. I think there is definitely a place with it in terms of a nature documentary, because it's showcasing, you know, even though you guys are looking for the fungi and the mushrooms and there's amazing pictures and time lapse, you're really showcasing culture as well, including a rather vivid scene in one of the villages where different animist tribes are jumping in this lake with these massive wooden totem poles that they're running around with in the lake, and the whole village gets into it. I mean, you're showcasing some things that are really incredible, that, you know, on the human side of things, that, you know, I never heard of before.
Yeah, we took one of the guys from Ballapara Foundation. One of them had to leave and go to a wedding. So he left, and another guy came along and filled in for him. And the guy that came along was an accountant. He didn't say a lot, but we took him along to the Badium Clam Festival. And at the end of it, he just said, "Oh, thank you so much. I've never seen anything like it in my life before." And he's Indian. You know, the Khasi people in Meghalaya who celebrate this, all of the peoples, they have their local Badium Clam Festival.
Yeah.
Very few other people anywhere in India have ever heard of it before. So, you know, when we went along there, there's crowd. Everyone in the town turns up.
Yeah, a ton of people.
But no one else. There weren't any European tourists. There was a handful of Indian tourists, but just a handful. It was just locals. And festivals like that, everyone gets involved. Great fun.
Although we didn't get to see you tromping around out in the lake with everyone.
Yeah, I was taking you. They were pretty rough out in the lake. You tended to get very wet.
Yeah, it seemed like a kind of like a giant mosh pit almost.
Yeah, it was exactly that. I was tempted to go out, but I restrained.
Well, I hope we've given enough people enough reasons, aside from even just the mushrooms, to see the documentary and, like I said, spread it around and, you know, get that viral spread growing, because I think it's really an amazing story that you guys are able to tell. And important, you know, I think it gives back a lot to that area. So that's fantastic. Now, as we kind of wind down here, I do have three questions that I ask all my guests. And I think you'll have some pretty unique perspectives here. And the first one of those is a mushroom that you love and why. And I know you've already named some really striking and beautiful and magnificent mushrooms and fungi already. So it can be one of those again, or just one you thought of right now, or an all-time favorite, whatever the case is. But what's a mushroom you love and why? Why should we know about it?
I'll go for Mycena interrupta. It was one of those mushrooms where I did look for it to find it. And the blue mushroom, which is quite common in Tasmania, also Victoria, you get a similar species in Chile and in New Zealand, I think. But it's this beautiful little blue mushroom, and it's just stunning. The blue color in it just varies so much, and the patterning, sometimes it's just every second gill seems to be by blue, vivid blue in the center of the cap and pale on the outside. It just never ceases to amaze.
I believe that is probably one of the most viral mushroom pictures that you'll see on the internet. I may be crossing my wires, but I know it's a bright blue mycena with that variated color that you see showing up on all these different pages. If they post a picture of a mushroom, that's like the iconic mycena that you see all over the place for good reason, because it is just absolutely stunning. And then we've hinted at this next question kind of around the edges, but what has a relationship with fungi, with mushrooms? What has that given to you? What has that, and this can be spiritual, emotional, whatever the case is.
Oh, it's pretty all encompassing. I think, by now that most of what I do when I travel, there's always an element of fungus in it.
Right.
Even in the dry season now, we usually travel in the wet season now. Like most people, when they look to travel somewhere, they look at the rainfall and they say, okay, we want to go in the dry season because we don't want to be there in rain. Right. We do the exact opposite. We go in the wet season. And actually, there's a lot of advantages to that. Everything is more alive in the wet season. The forest is alive. The dry season, everything closes down a bit. And yeah, it's nice weather for swimming. Well, not necessarily, because it's not necessarily warm. But the wet season has so many advantages, and there's no tourists.
That's a great point. So there are a lot of advantages to traveling in the wet season, besides just the amazing mushrooms that you might find. And I would imagine at this point it is all-encompassing in terms of the effect it's had. That's terrific. And then what is the lasting impact that you hope to have with your work, whether it's documentaries, whether it's pictures? You know, and this isn't something that has to aggrandize Steve Axford, but maybe that is the impact you hope for. But what do you hope this contributes to in the world?
I just hope that it helps move people's understanding of mushrooms on a little bit. I can add my little bit in pretty pictures, essentially. Pictures mean an enormous amount. It's something I've come to realize. Before, I'd take pictures and I think, well, they're just pretty pictures, really, aren't they? They're a lot more than that because they get people excited about mushrooms.
Yeah.
And if that's what I can leave, that is just moved everyone on a little bit. I've influenced a few people. There's lots of people who get into mushrooms and everyone adds their little bit. In the time I've been looking at mushrooms from, say, about early 2000s to now, it's been a huge change. Like with the BBC, when they first put out Planet Earth 2, that was the first time they'd really showcased mushrooms at all.
Yeah.
And they just showed the pretty pictures. They're planning on their next programs are going to look into mushrooms a bit more and start looking at what mushrooms do and how they interact with the environment. So everything's moved on a little bit. And I've helped move it on just a tiny bit. Lots of other people have helped as well. But it's just that gradual moving on, gradual education of everyone, including myself.
That's one of the biggest contributions you can have right now, is getting people more tuned into this organism that we're overlooking that is so critically important. And I think with something like mushrooms or fungi, that either you can't see them, or, you know, at least for a majority of their life, because the big fruiting body is ephemeral and dissolves after a short amount of time, something like a picture is particularly potent for something like that, that is mysterious and unseen for much of its life. You know, you get a beautiful picture of it, and there's just a very powerful energy around that. You know, the experience of seeing something that you won't get a chance to see very often, and be able to see it for however long you want. So I definitely think it has a big effect on people.
After the first trips to Yunnan, they produced a field guide for Nabunhe Rainforest.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the locals sitting there with the book, and, you know, say three or four of them going through the book and pointing at pictures and talking to each other. I have no idea what they said, of course. But they were excited by seeing things that they knew from the forest. They went through every page on the book talking about the mushrooms on the pages of the book. So it had an impact on them. Everywhere we go, we get the same sort of effect. People love the photographs.
Well, if you can inspire curiosity and passion and love for something like fungi or mushrooms with what you do, then I think you're doing something incredibly worthwhile. And like I said before the show, I'm a huge fan. So this has been a pleasure to get the chance to speak with you, to learn more about you and your journey, and really inspiring. And I look forward to seeing many more pictures and hopefully more documentaries in the future. And I just really appreciate you coming on the Mushroom Hour and speaking with us. It's been an honor.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.